Okay, so first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop. Unfortunately, I can only stay for a brief amount of time, but I'm glad to be here today, and thank you for giving me the chance to present some of our recent work. So first of all, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So this was work done by Nikolai Zerf, who was a postdoc at Alberta, is now moved to Heidelberg, my current postdoc, Chen-Hung Lin in Alberta, and also Will Vichakrempa, whom I think many of you know, who is now starting as a faculty member at the University of Montreal. And the work I'll be talking about today is reported in these two papers. Okay, so in the last decade or so, we've witnessed the discovery of interesting new states of matter called topological states of matter. So essentially, these are states that have some sort of band topology in the bulk, either gapped or gapless. And as a result of this bulk topology, they have interesting surface states via some sort of bulk edge correspondence. And so although many topological states of matter have been predicted theoretically, only a handful have been realized experimentally. So in particular, the last few years, we've seen the discovery of topological insulators and topological superconductors, which are states of matter that are gapped in the bulk and then have interesting surface states, and also via semimetals, which are gapless in the bulk, but nonetheless have some interesting bulk topology. And as a result, they have these interesting Fermi arcs, which instead of being a closed Fermi surface, are sort of disconnected and interesting. And what is interesting about these states is that they have interesting surface or edge states. So in the case of topological insulators, one has essentially a massless two-dimensional Dirac fermions on their surface. In the case of topological superconductors, we have the sort of non-particle number conserving version of that, which are Majorana fermions. And experimentally, so far, only the one-dimensional topological superconductor has been unambiguously seen. And so these have zero-dimensional gapless Majorana fermions at their boundary. And also, even more recently, via semimetals and their Fermi arcs have been observed. Okay, so this is very interesting. And so what I would like to argue here is that these gapless surface states form novel, essentially universality classes of fermionic vacua. And as a result, if we add interactions to these systems, so far, most of these systems can be understood from the point of view of non-interacting electron physics, or maybe sort of at the mean field, Bogoliubov-Degen sense for the topological superconductor. And so if we add interactions to these systems, then maybe we can hope that we can get new types of quantum criticality in these systems. And the reason for that is that these surface states have somewhat of an anomalous character in the sense that you cannot realize these surface states if you want to maintain all the symmetries of the system in a lattice model of the same dimension. So in particular, if you try to realize a two-dimensional massless Dirac fermion with time reversal and parity symmetries, then you cannot realize a single species of massless Dirac fermions in two dimensions in a lattice model, in a two-dimensional lattice model. Okay, so that's why these surface states are interesting. And what I'll talk about today is the fact that if you have a single massless Dirac fermion in two dimensions, then in the presence of interactions, you can have an interesting phase transition at zero temperature from a semimetal to a superconductor. And as we'll see, this transition has some interesting properties. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. So I'll begin by a review of the corresponding transition for bosons, if you will, which is the transition between a superconductor to an insulator of bosons. And then I'll move on to the meat of the talk, which is the transition, the sort of fermionic version of that, which is a transition between a semimetal and a superconductor for a single flavor of 2D massless Dirac fermions. And as we'll see, there is claims that there is an emergent N equal 2 supersymmetry at this transition. So I'll present some results for critical exponents and also for some response properties at this critical point. Okay, so let's talk a bit about the warm-up, which is the superconductor insulator transition for bosons in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so essentially we have two phases. There's a phase where the bosons are insulating, and then a phase where the boson condense and form a superfluid or a superconducting phase. And above this critical point, we have the usual quantum critical funnel. Okay, so how does one realize this phase transition? So there's essentially two possible routes, at least. So the first one is to consider a Josephson junction array. Okay, so in this system, we have essentially metallic islands, which at low temperature become superconducting, and so we have the formation of Cooper pairs on these islands. And now we consider that these islands form an array and are weakly coupled by some insulating tunnel junctions. And so essentially the Hamiltonian has two terms. There's a term which corresponds to the Josephson coupling between these islands, and this is this term with the Josephson energy E sub j. And essentially this term tries to lock the superconducting phase or the superfluid phase between two neighboring islands. But in addition to that term, there's also a charging energy term, which essentially, because of the fact that this island essentially has some capacitance, so there's some energy associated with the total charge that is being piled up on this island. And so these two terms compete. And what is important here is that we assume that these energy scales are much less than the single particle or the pairing gap on the island, such that there's no pair breaking processes. And so we, even though these Cooper pairs are formed out of fermionic electrons, we assume that the energies are such that there's no pair breaking. And so we have no low energy fermions that we should consider at the transition. And so in other words, it's a purely bosonic model. And so there's a competition between these two terms because the number of, so this n sub I here is the number of, the number operator for the bosonic Cooper pairs. And so the number and the phase are conjugate variables. And as a result, these two terms compete with each other. And as a result of this competition at zero temperature, we have a transition between essentially a Cooper pair insulator and a superconductor, where essentially if tuned by this ratio between the charging energy and the Josephson energy. And essentially what happens is that if the Josephson energy is the dominant energy scale, then really what is favored is the locking of the superfluid phase between neighboring islands. And as a result, there's a long range ordering of the Josephson phase in the system. Whereas if the charging energy is the dominant energy scale, then we tend to fix the number of Cooper pairs on each island. And as a result, there's wild fluctuations of the phase that destroy the long range superfluid order. Okay. So that's in theory. So this was realized in practice many years ago already. So for instance, in this work, in the late 80s, so arrays of aluminum arrays were fabricated, and there, depending on the resistance of each array, you'll see that at some given temperature, as you lower the temperature, you will either see insulating or superconducting behavior. And a little bit later, one can even actually map the phase diagram in the plane of this non-thermal tuning parameter and temperature, and you see that there's essentially a finite temperature phase transition, which is in the Kosulitz-Dallas universality class. And then this leads to a quantum critical point at some value of EC over EJ, which is about 1.7. Okay, so that's route one. There's also another route, which is to consider loading a boson-sent condensate in an optical lattice. So essentially here what we have is a near-ideal realization of the 2D Bose-Hubbard model. So here we have three terms in the Hamiltonian. There is a term which essentially is describes the hopping of bosonic atoms from one lattice side to another with some hopping energy J. There's a chemical potential for the bosons. And finally, there's some on-site repulsive energy U. And so this is a schematic phase diagram of this Hamiltonian. And so if the boson hopping is large enough, then the bosons can travel through the lattice and we have a superfluid phase. Whereas if the boson hopping is too small, then we have localization of the bosons on the sides of this optical lattice, and we have these mod insulating phases, which are characterized by various integer occupation numbers of the bosons on the sides of the lattice. Okay. Yes.
Can you go back to this Josephson?
Yes. Oh, sorry. Here.
Yeah. Go one.
This one.
So what would be the in this Cooper pair insulator? Like the formula form a pair, but they don't condense. So what's the experimental evidence for
preforming
the Cooper pair?
Oh, the fact that the well, I think, I mean, first of all, you know that the these aluminum, so aluminum at a given temperature, so at the temperatures at which they're performing these measurements, aluminum by itself is known to be superconducting. And also, I think that you can see some if you do some STM measurement, you can see some pairing gap locally on the island.
So if the if I don't consider aluminum, some other system, if the quadriparticle, has a well, quadriparticle has a nodal point, does it affect this kind of?
Yeah, like a D-wave Josephson junction array.
Like
yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if this has been realized. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so if we go back to this BEC in an optical lattice, okay, so depending on whether you are at some commensurate filling or some incommensurate filling, in fact, the universality class of the phase transition will be different. So there are essentially two possible cases. Either you are not at a commensurate filling, or you are. So in either case, actually, this has been observed experimentally, starting from the pioneering work of Ian Spielman in 2007, and more recent works where one can really pinpoint the position of the phase transition. So, so this first experiment here in the group of Chin at University of Chicago using cesium atoms, so there they consider, in fact, the transition from the superfluid to the vacuum. So they're considering that the chemical potential is tuned basically near and then eventually below the band of the non-attracting bosons, and there you can see that in fact the so they map the occupation number distribution, and from that, using the equation of state, they can map the position of the phase transition, and the scaling that they observe is consistent with the prediction from theory, which is that you should have a dynamic critical exponent z equal 2 away from commensurate filling. And now, if you are at commensurate filling, then an experiment in the group of Emmanuel Bloch, 2012, here in fact one can map the amplitude of the Higgs mode of the superfluid, and in fact we see that the mode goes soft at a transition, and this allows one to pinpoint the position of the phase transition. And here one observes a z equal 1 critical exponent, so we have a essentially a relativistic field theory describing the critical point. Okay. Okay, so if we focus on this relativistic case, then we can write down a Landau-Ginzburg theory, which describes the phase transition. And so we start from some, so now we're doing field theory, so we're working with a log wavelength description. And so we in this coarse graining process, the bosonic degrees of freedom, whether they are the Cooper pair in the Josephson junction array problem or whether they are the bosonic atoms themselves, in the cold atoms realization, we have a complex scalar order parameters, as was discussed by one of the previous speakers this morning. And so we obtain a Lagrangian, which is relativistic. So there's a time derivative term, there's some spatial gradient term with some non-universal velocity, and there is a Mexican hat potential. And so the mass of this boson is essentially the non-thermal tuning parameter, which is either this EC over EJ in the Josephson junction problem or, for instance, the boson hopping over the interaction in the Bose-Hubbard problem. And so if this mass becomes negative, then we have a spontaneous breaking of U1 symmetry, and we enter the superfluid phase. Okay. So now if we focus at the on the critical point, so we try to extract critical properties. And so if we look at this Lagrangian, so in 2 plus 1 dimensions, this phi to the fourth term is a relevant variable. And so this means that the quantum critical point, by opposition to the z equal 2 critical point, is strongly coupled. And it's in the universality class of the O2-Wilson-Fisher model, which is essentially the 3D XY universality class. And we have emergent Lorentz invariance z equal 1. OK, so what about physical properties at this critical point? So in particular, we can try to determine the optical connectivity. Okay, so the optical connectivity is given by the Kubo formula, which is a current-current correlation function. So here, at zero momentum, but finite frequency and temperature. And we can compute this because we have a U1 current that is the boson current that is conserved at the critical point. Okay. And so we know from seminal work by Kedar Damli and Subir Sajdev that if you are at a critical point, scale invariance will imply that most physical properties, including the optical connectivity, follow some scaling laws. So there is the quantum of conductance times some temperature-dependent prefactor, which depends on the spatial dimension and the dynamic critical exponent of your critical point times some universal scaling function, which is a function of the dimensionless ratio between the frequency at which you're measuring the optical connectivity and the temperature. Okay, and we've seen plots of the optical connectivity in the holographic theories earlier this morning. And so in general, we will have some universal scaling function, which has two limits that are interesting. One limit is the limit that the frequency is much less than the temperature. That would be what we would measure in a DC connectivity measurement. And here, this would be the limit of very low temperatures, but at finite frequency. Okay. So in particular, if we focus on the case of two spatial dimensions, then d equals 2, so this prefactor disappears, and we are left with the universal quantum of conductance times this dimensionless scaling function. So in particular, if we try to focus on the zero temperature optical connectivity, okay, so setting omega to zero, and so considering, rather setting t equals zero, but considering omega finite, then this tells us that the optical connectivity as a function of frequency at zero temperature should be a constant. Okay, so the optical response should be completely flat, and it should be given by some universal number, which is the limit of infinite argument of the scaling function times this quantum of conductance. Okay, and so again, I want to stress that this is the opposite limit that was discussed earlier. So this is not a DC transport coefficient. This is a zero temperature finite frequency transport coefficient. Okay. And this is, so this is related to the ground state or zero temperature current-current correlation function by the Kubo formula. Okay, so the question is, what is this universal number at the boson superconductor to insulator transition? So this problem has a long history. There's no exact results. So starting from some seminal work by Fisher, Grinstein, and Gervin in the 90s and continuing on to this day, a lot of work was expanded on this problem, and only recently via some pioneering work using a combination of quantum Monte Carlo and holographic methods. So this is work of Subir and collaborators, also Gazit et al., and also alternatively using the conformal bootstrap approach, which is a numerical but non-perturbative method for determining the scaling dimensions of conformal field theories in dimensions higher than 1 plus 1. Okay, so via combination of all these methods, now we have not an exact, but a very accurate, a reliable numerical value for this universal connectivity.
Is there any other physical observable that contains this number? Then you can, use this optical connectivity divided by the other quantity to get some more universal number.
Yeah, so in this one, I'm not sure, but in the theory that I'll talk about next, there is such a ratio. Because you would need to have something that is related in some way to the electrical current. And so if there's no, so there are ratios of, there are ratios for DC coefficients, but for this high temperature coefficient, this high frequency coefficient, unless you have some special relation between the current and some other operator, in this theory, I don't think there's a universal ratio you can write down, as far as I know.
So this is
high frequency.
T equals zero, right?
T equals zero, exactly. T equals zero.
This is a universal number.
This is a universal.
Yeah, okay.
That's right.
This will hold for any theory in the OTB.
That's right, in this addition Roselli class. Was that your question?
I'm asking a question like, is there any other physical observable that contain this universal number? Then you use that the other observable divided by the
Optical
connectivity to get something independent from this number.
Yeah, so it's some sort of super universality. So, you have that for the next theory that I'll talk about. For this one, apart from the optical connectivity, I'm not sure it would be related to that property. It would have to involve the electric current, sort of thing, or maybe some density response, but that's a good question.
What those more recent papers really trying to handle almost zero frequency answer. That's even harder.
Which?
Like this use of holography and so on, and continuation. I thought that was all about getting the low frequency method. I know they have a discussion of high frequency as well.
Well, I know that at least these particular papers address this, among other things, they address this high frequency. Yeah. So there, actually, in a sense, the analytic continuation is easier because if you're at high frequency, you don't have to worry about, right, I omega n goes to omega, basically, and that's it. Okay, so okay, so moving on. So the problem that I'm really interested in is this sort of fermionic version of this bosonic problem, where now we have Dirac fermions becoming superconducting, and there, as we'll see in a second, essentially we have to keep the low energy fermions in the description, and they strongly mix at the critical point. Okay, and we obtain a novel universality class. Okay, so essentially in this case we have, as we'll see again in a bit, we have bosonic degrees of freedom describing the bosonic Cooper pairs, but we also have these massless Dirac fermions that at the mean field level will open up a gap whenever the fermions pair, and simultaneously we have a condensation of the bosonic order parameter. Okay, and that's what we'll talk about now. So, okay, so now as a physical setting, I'll be considering a single massless Dirac fermion in two dimensions, such as can be found on the surface of a 3D topological insulator. So in general, in these systems, the chemical potential is not at any particular value, but there are methods to tune this chemical potential. And so here I'll assume that the chemical potential is placed at the position of the Dirac point, such that essentially we have an emergent, we have a Lorentz invariance for the massless Dirac fermion sector. So, okay, so we have a two-component Dirac fermion, which physically corresponds simply to the spin up and spin down. Okay, and if we consider that the chemical potential is at the Dirac point, then we'll have a vanishing density of states at this Dirac point. And so this implies, by opposition to the standard Cooper instability, that we have a quantum critical point. Okay, meaning that if I consider the strength of some attractive interaction between the fermions, such as produced, for example, via the electron-phonon interaction, then I need to overcome some threshold interaction strength to develop superconductivity. Okay, so if the interaction is too weak, then these fermions do not pair, and we have a gapless Dirac semimetal. And if the interaction is greater than this critical interaction, then the fermions will pair, and we essentially get a gapped S-wave superconductor.
What if it's true positive?
Sorry?
What if it's
repulsive? Oh, if it's repulsive, then something you could have is, for instance, so this mass term breaks the U1 symmetry. You could have a mass term which is essentially the regular mass term psi bar psi, and that will open a gap, but that will be like that would correspond to ferromagnetism in the z direction.
So that's what I
wanted
to ask. Are you
doing time reversal? Here, yes, in a sense. In the physical realization, I'm considering time reversal. It may not be strictly necessary, but the field theory that I'll write down is time reversal invariant.
The Dirac mass is relevant to time reversal.
That's right, exactly, that's right. But for an attractive interaction, you typically wouldn't get, with repulsive interactions, you would develop a psi bar psi order parameter. With attractive interactions, this is what you tend to get. At least in mean field, that's what you would get. As far as I know. So how would you engineer this in practice? So again, there's sort of two realizations one could think about. The first one was proposed by Pedro Ponte and Seung-Sik Lee a few years back. So the idea would be to take your topological insulator with the massless Dirac surface state, but now deposit a Josephson junction array of the type that I've talked about at the beginning of the talk. And then we imagine a process in which now these tightly bound Cooper pairs can now tunnel into the massless metallic surface state and then break up into pairs of independent electrons, and then these electrons can also hop back onto the island and then form Cooper pairs. Okay, so now we have coupled bosonic Cooper pair degrees of freedom and the fermionic electrons on the surface. Okay, so if you try to write down the Landau-Ginzburg theory for this problem, then essentially you could start with a two decoupled system, so you would have a Dirac Lagrangian with some velocity describing your massless Dirac cone, and then you would have a bosonic Lagrangian of the type that I wrote earlier to describe the Josephson junction sector, in general with a different velocity. Okay, so in general, you wouldn't have equal velocity, you wouldn't have Lorentz invariance in a kinetic matter system, but now you need to take into account the fact that Dirac electrons can hop onto the island, the superconducting island, and back. Okay, so if you study this theory, at the mean field level, then you basically find that is if this mass, boson mass is tuned to zero, you get a critical point. And if you have a negative mass for the boson, okay, I guess I should have switched these phases around. So if R is negative, then you will develop an expectation value for this field. And this, in turn, via this sort of Yukawa coupling, you will develop a mass for the fermion. Now, trivially, if R is positive, then there is no U1 symmetry breaking. Okay, so that would be root one. What about root two? So there you could expect that, you could imagine that intrinsic superconductivity would develop in the system, essentially via standard electron-phonon interactions if you go to sufficiently low temperatures. So there seems to be a hint that maybe this has already been realized, although there's some possible issues. But so this was a paper published last year in the group of Leah Krushenel by Makuni, where they reported that at sufficiently low temperatures, we have emergent surface superconductivity occurring in the Dirac surface states of this lesser-known topological insulator, antimony telluride, okay, which nonetheless has still a single Dirac cone on the surface. Okay, so the evidence they have is the following. So first of all, they have a material that, at least according to them, is quite well insulating in the bulk. So there's no lower energy fermionic degrees of freedom in the bulk. And so really, we have a surface metal. But nonetheless, if we lower the temperature to below about 8.6 Kelvin, they see a resistive transition. And furthermore, they see some anisotropic diamagnetism. So here the idea is to try to measure the Meissner effect. And so they apply some magnetic field. And what they see is that if the magnetic field is applied perpendicular to the surface, there's very little diamagnetism. But if the field is applied normal to the surface, then there's a large diamagnetism that develops below some temperature. Okay, so there's a bit of a discrepancy between the resistive TC here and the temperature below which you have this large diamagnetism. So if you also look at some STM measurements that they made, there seems to be actually some disorder in the system. And essentially what you may see happening is that there's some local phase coherence at a temperature of about something like 50 Kelvin, but then you get global phase coherence only below some lower temperature. So this might support the idea of superconducting puddles that are connected together by some Josephson coupling. So it's clearly not a very clean system, but at least there is the evidence that maybe one could hope realizing a sort of clean intrinsic superconductivity in these metallic Dirac surface states. Okay, so even if this was the case, how would you tune through the critical point where here one can borrow an idea from, again, Ponty and Lee, which is that if you have a metallic gate above your system a certain distance away from the metallic surface state, then this will act as an additional screening channel. And there what you might be able to do is tune the residual Coulomb interaction between the carriers on the surface. And as a result, this would tune the effective BCS interaction strength, okay, by varying perhaps the distance from the surface to this metallic gate. Maybe you could tune the critical point. Okay, so at least in principle, there might be a way of realizing this quantum critical point. Okay, so let's talk about the critical point itself. So the first interesting result is that if you try to access the critical point, so you work in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, where these you can control the flow of these phi to the fourth and Yukawa couplings, the first thing you find is that actually the fermion and boson velocities flow towards each other, so at the one loop level, and therefore the first thing you get is that you get the emergent Lorentz invariance. So this was shown by Sung-Sik Lee in some different but related model already about 10 years back. What is even more interesting is that, in fact, not only the velocities flow towards each other, but actually these two couplings, the phi to the fourth coupling and the Yukawa coupling, also flow towards each other such that, in fact, at the quantum critical point, you have an emergent supersymmetry. Okay, so this was realized over a number of years by these authors. So now you have a supersymmetric conformal field theory. In fact, you have a superconformal field theory, which was known in the high energy physics literature already many years ago, which is known as the N equal 2 Vesuvino model. You can think of this as some fermionic or supersymmetric version of the O2 Wilson Fischer fixed point. And because of the fact that this, so not only the phi to the fourth coupling is finite at a critical point, as it is for the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, but also this Yukawa coupling is finite. So you have a strongly interacting universality class like 3DXY, but it's not 3DXY because you also have a finite Yukawa interaction. Okay, so it's a new universality class.
Is there a modulus, or is it a lambda equals h?
Yes.
Is it a line or a point?
Well, in a sense, in the epsilon expansion, there is a universal value.
It's a point.
It's a point. Single point. Yeah, that's right. There's no other tuning parameter. Yes.
Is the quality established at any loop order, or is it just a certain loop order?
Yeah. So that's so I'll address that in a bit. Okay. So the answer is it survives at least a three loop. So you can ask what are the properties of this critical point. So first of all, you can try to calculate the anomalous dimensions. So one first consequence of supersymmetry is that the fermion and the boson have the same anomalous dimension. So in the supersymmetric language, these are essentially two components of the same chiral superfield. And so it's not surprising that they have the same anomalous dimension. What is interesting is that supersymmetry, in fact, fixes exactly the anomalous dimension. And so this was already proved here in this early work. And the anomalous dimension is 1/3, so it's a large anomalous dimension. So you really have a strongly coupled critical point. What about other exponents? So the correlation length exponent is actually not fixed by supersymmetry, so there are some radiative corrections that you have to take into account. So one can do the epsilon expansion, and at the one loop level, you can compute this, and it's about 0.75, so there's a fairly large deviation already at one loop order from the Gaussian exponent 1/2. What about higher loops? So to answer your question, okay, so you might ask, well, is this an artifact of the one loop beta function? So we don't know the exact beta function. In fact, it's entirely possible that even though there is a consistent superconformal field theory in three dimensions with these scaling exponents, it could be that the beta function of the theory never reaches that fixed point. So all we can do in the absence of exact results is to try to compute the beta function to higher order. So we did it to three loop order. This is the flow diagram here. It's qualitatively the same as in the one loop level. So there's a Gaussian fixed point, the Wilson-Fisher fixed point in the absence of this Yukawa fixed point, this Yukawa coupling, but both are unstable in the infrared and you flow to this supersymmetric critical point. And so here what I've plotted is the value of the critical coupling at the supersymmetric fixed point as a function of space-time dimension at fixed loop order, so at three loop order. Okay, so of course it's not an exact result, but what you see is that at three loop order, the critical dimension below which this fixed point disappears and becomes imaginary is 1.62. Okay, so in three space-time dimensions, you're very far away from this critical dimension. So at least at three loop order, this fixed point is certainly stable. Okay, if you were to extrapolate epsilon from 0 to 1.
One question.
Yes.
What controls the expansion in this case? Are you relying on epsilon being small, or there's any emergent parameter that controls?
No, so this is just epsilon expansion. See, the only thing, of course, I can prove is that at three loop order for epsilon small, the critical point is stable. What I'm just saying here is that if I were to extrapolate this three loop result to finite epsilon, I would find that the fixed point would disappear only at a value of epsilon that is greater than 1. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Yes.
So how many relevant operators?
This critical point?
Yeah.
Only one.
Only one.
Yeah, it's a quantum critical point. One relevant operator, which is the bosonic master. Yeah.
It has only one time reversible variant.
That's right. You could write some. Yeah, you could. That's right. You can write operators that break symmetry. So you can write, for instance, a psi psi master, which breaks you one symmetry and is relevant. And you could certainly write down a psi bar psi operator. Absolutely, that's right. So if you preserve the symmetries, which are preserved along the RG flow, then there's only one relevant perturbation. Okay, so what about the correlation length exponent? So I already quoted the one loop result. So we put the calculation to three loop. If you extrapolate this result naively, you get this again, fairly large correction compared to 0.75. Of course, you should never really do that. So what you can do is you can try to do a Padé extrapolation of the three-loop result to try to obtain a better estimate of the correlation exponent. And what you find is 0.9174. And if you do the calculation using the conformal bootstrap, then you find 0.9173. Okay, so at least there are two results that are quite close. And so it seems that we now have a pretty good value for this critical exponent, which again is quite quite different from the Gaussian one-half exponent. Okay, so this was for exponents. What about other physical properties? So I sort of set the stage by discussing the optical conductivity for the superconductor insulator transition of bosons. So now what about the fermionic problem? Okay, so again, we're in 2+1 dimensions. I'm interested in the zero temperature finite frequency conductivity. So it's flat, and it should be given by some universal number times e squared over h bar. Okay, so so now the theory has fermions. So what do we know about fermions as a little warm up? So if you have a free Dirac fermion, then that is a conformal field theory if the chemical potential is at mu equals zero. And so you could try to calculate this conductivity. You can do a Kubo formula calculation. It's free fermions. It's easy. And so if you find if you have a single massless 2D Dirac fermion, you would find that sigma infinity is 1/16. What is interesting, actually, is that this result has been experimentally measured, essentially. So if you consider graphene, so graphene has four species of 2D massless Dirac fermions, two spins and two valleys. So you should get a sigma infinity of 1/4. And in fact, if you measure the optical conductivity, which was done in this paper, I think there's an earlier result by Gein, but this one is a bit cleaner. And so here they measure the optical conductivity in some range of photon energies, which is about 1 eV. And they do this at room temperature, 300 Kelvin. And so if you take this ratio of h bar omega over kBT, it's 39. It's quite large. And so in a sense, you should expect that you might be at least near this regime where the conductivity is spectrally flat. And as you can see, at least in some range of photon energies, it's quite flat. And if you look at this, the average value, that is found that it basically matches this 1/4. Okay, this is this dotted line. Okay, so that's what you would expect for free massless Dirac fermions. Okay, so in our case, we don't have free massless Dirac fermions because they are strongly coupled to the bosonic fluctuations. Okay, and so we need to go beyond that. Okay, so how would you go about computing this thing? So you would want to use the Kubo formula. You would calculate the ground state current-current correlation function. So the first thing you know is that if you have conformal invariance, then there's already a lot of constraints. So this was discussed by this classic paper by Osborne and Petko in 94, where they discussed the constraints imposed by conformal invariance in higher dimensions, so not in 1+1, in higher dimensions, where the conformal group is finite dimensional. So the constraints of this symmetry on correlation functions, such as the current-current correlation function. Okay, so what you find is that basically this current-current correlation function is given by some universal constant, which is not determined by conformal symmetry, times some function which has no free parameters, which is a function of this space-time separation here. Okay, so what you do is if you want to determine the conductivity, you Fourier transform this and you work in the frequency domain, and what you find is that, not too surprisingly, this zero temperature finite frequency conductivity is directly proportional to this coefficient Cj. Okay. So the question is, can we compute this coefficient Cj at our critical point? Okay. So the first thing that will help us is that is this interesting property of n equal 2 supercool formal field theories in 2+1 dimension. Okay, so it turns out that in these theories, the U1 current, which for us is the electric current, and the stress tensor are related by supersymmetry. Okay, so they are in the same multiplet of supersymmetry, or in other words, they are two different components of the same superfield, curly J mu, so it contains both the bosonic J mu, and then there's these Grassmann variables, and then we have the stress tensor T mu. So what this means is that because of this symmetry that relates J mu and T mu nu, then the current-current correlation function is related by supersymmetry to the correlation function of the stress tensor. Okay, so again, employing a conformal invariance, you can show that the TT correlator is given by some universal function with no adjustable parameters of the space-time separation times another universal constant, which depends on the CFT at hand. It's not fixed by conformal symmetry. But using supersymmetry, you can show that there's a universal ratio between the two, okay, which is 5/3 for n equal 2 superconformal field theories in 2+1 dimension. Okay. So this already has an interesting consequence from a physics point of view, which is that there is a universal relation between the shear viscosity and the conductivity. So again, add zero temperature, finite frequency, add this type of critical point. Okay, so I wasn't here yesterday, but I'm sure that Leonid gave a beautiful discussion of viscosity, and we also heard about viscosity earlier today. So this is just a brief reminder of what this is. So if I consider a two-dimensional quantum fluid, and I would consider somehow pinning the fluid with some boundary plate here at the bottom of the fluid, and here somehow I have a moving boundary plate, then this would set up a velocity gradient along this direction. And the shear viscosity measures the resistance of this fluid to this motion. Okay, so if you take two neighboring layers of fluid, then if there's a finite shear viscosity, then you will this velocity gradient will develop some force that is parallel to this layer, and the shear stress is essentially the amount of force on this layer divided by the length of this layer. And so the shear viscosity tells you what is the constant of proportionality between the applied velocity gradient and the stress tensor. Okay. Now, because the velocity is basically x dot, this can be understood, as was discussed earlier this morning, as some time-dependent deformation of the metric. And so now this looks very much like the Kubo formula for the electrical conductivity. So if you think of the fact that the stress tensor couples to the metric in very much the same way the electric current couples to a vector potential, then this is basically like if you had J equals sigma E, where E would be given by A dot. Okay, so as a result, just like the electrical conductivity is given by 1 over omega, the JJ correlation function, so is eta given by 1 over omega, the TT correlation function. Okay, so again, here I want to stress that this is it's not a DC viscosity, so it's not quite clear, at least to me right now, how you measure this, but this is a zero temperature, finite frequency, dynamical viscosity in a sense. Okay, and so by conformal symmetry, this has to have precisely this form where now we have some universal omega square dependence and there's a constant prefactor, which depends on the CFT. Okay, so because of this relation between, this constant coefficient in the TT correlation function is directly proportional to this shear viscosity. And so if we know CT, we know the shear viscosity. Okay, so the first consequence of supersymmetry is that actually these two coefficients have a universal ratio, okay, which is true at this quantum critical point, but in fact should be true of any quantum critical point with n equal 2 supersymmetry. Okay, so that's a bit of some kind of super universality, which is a consequence of SUSY.
Could something like this survive the finite omega? Are the whole functions related?
In principle, yes, because this is really at zero temperature, this is, so in a sense, what I've taken out is this omega square dependence. Okay, but by conformal invariance, as long as you stay within the range of frequencies where you don't have some non-universal UV physics coming into play, then this is really the full omega dependence at zero temperature.
What about function omega over T?
Omega over T?
Is
okay.
Also, also related by
so I'll talk about finite T in a bit. That would be the last part of my talk. Yeah. Okay, so for now, this is strictly at zero temperature. Okay, so so what helps us is that actually this CT can be computed exactly for the n equal 2 Vesey-Minow model by a method called localization. So I want to explain the details, but basically what happens is that if you have n equal 2 supersymmetry in three space-time dimensions, you can calculate exactly the partition function of the field theory if you have a superconformal field theory on the three sphere, and if you squash this three sphere, you essentially are considering metric deformations, and if you take a functional derivative of this partition function with respect to these metric deformations, you can extract the stress sensor or correlation function. Okay, and that's how you can get CT exactly. Okay, so using this, we arrive at an exact closed form result for the optical conductivity at zero temperature of something that one could think is a realistic strongly coupled quantum fluid in 2+1 dimension. Okay, so interestingly, it's actually quite close to the numerically to the value for the boson insulator.
E or 4e or?
Oh, this is that's right. That's right for the. Oh, did we convert? The 0.226,
so the 0.226,
I think this is 4
e squared over
h. I think it's
4
e squared over
h bar.
Is it,
the answer is 116.
No, but we
in,
for the free boson,
which is right, which is pretty close to 1.25. It's, you know, not that far from the free boson value of 116.
Yes.
And then it becomes 0.23 by multiplying by a factor of 2.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so what we considered was, yeah. So let's look at this light here. So in our units at the Gaussian fixed point, we have a single massless Dirac fermion, and we have a charge 2 Cooper pair. We obtain, so there's 116 coming from the fermion, and we have 416 for the boson.
Right.
So we took care of the, so this is in physical electron charge units. And so the 0.226 should be
in units of 4 e squared.
No, this should be in units of e squared over h bar.
The last
one? Yes. No?
I think
we converted it correctly, but maybe we can double check again.
I mean, I went through this with William.
Yeah.
I can't read out, straightened out. What you're putting on the board doesn't seem consistent with my language.
Okay, we'll double check. Okay, so stop the recording. Okay, but so never mind what this result is. Of course, we should straighten that out. But what I want to say here is that, so there's quite a bit of reduced conductivity. Okay, so you might think that, okay, this is close to a... close to essentially the result if you only had bosons, but actually if you consider the Gaussian fixed point where you have both fermions and bosons, and naively you would expect that if you didn't have much coupling between the two, you should get something more like 0.3125. But as a result of strong scattering between these bosons and these fermions at the critical point, we have a much reduced conductivity. Okay, so that's how we sort of interpret this result. Okay, how much time do I have? I should be done now.
Sorry, you have another 10 minutes?
10 minutes, perfect. Okay, so more than enough. Okay, so besides this conductivity, okay, actually this closed form result allows us to give results for other properties, namely the entanglement entropy. Okay, so if you consider, again, your 2 plus 1 dimensional critical point, and now you consider some entangling region, with some volume V and some sharp corner with opening angle theta, then the entanglement entropy in general will have this form. And so there's a term that is independent of the angle, but now there's a subleading correction, which is logarithmic in this distance L, this length scale L, which has some dependence on the opening angle. Okay, and there was some interesting work a number of years ago that that predicted that the dependence for opening angles close to pi, so very obtuse angle, should be proportional to the deviation of this angle from pi squared times some universal coefficient. Okay, that only depends on the CFT at hand. Okay, then there was some later work by Pablo Bueno and Rob Myers here at Perimeter and others that first conjectured and then eventually proved that this coefficient lambda is directly proportional to this coefficient CT, which is again this coefficient in the appearing in the stress tensor two-point function, and so this allows us to give an exact result for this lambda. And in principle, so these results could be tested numerically, and hopefully maybe serve as a benchmark for numerical simulations of quantum critical points. Okay, so the final part of my talk is finite temperature. So what about finite temperature? So it turns out that if you consider the optical connectivity, and now at finite temperature, there's essentially an expansion that you can do in powers of the temperature over omega. So now we're considering the limit that T is much less than omega, but is finite now. Okay, and so the first term of this expansion is the identity. So this is a constant, which is the this constant that I've been talking about up till now. But now we have an expansion in powers of temperature, but it's not a trivial power series expansion. It's actually an expansion in increasing powers, which correspond to scaling dimensions of operators at the quantum critical point. Okay, so this was discussed in this very nice paper by Subir and collaborators. Okay, so I'll just briefly explain where this comes from. So this essentially comes from the operator product expansion. Okay, so we know that if you have a conformal field theory, then in general operators at the critical point will obey some operator product expansion. So essentially, if you have a product of two operators at two different points that are separated by some small distance x, Essentially, if we consider this operator inserted into some, this product of operators inserted in some correlation function, it will behave as though it was given by the sum of a sum of local operators, various operators evaluated essentially one of the two locations, let's say zero, divided by this this microscopic, this small distance to some power that depends on the scaling dimensions of the operators in the sum. Okay, so now if you insert this in the Kubo formula and you take a thermal expectation value, okay, so now if you're considering large frequencies, frequencies much greater than the temperature, which is essentially what we're considering here, then you know, large frequencies translate to small times. And if we consider a small temporal separation, then we can use this this operator product expansion. Okay. And we substitute this in here. If we take the thermal expectation value, then on the right-hand side, we will have the thermal expectation value of some operator. Okay. And if you do the Fourier transform, then you'll get essentially 1 over omega to delta of A, which is the scaling dimension of operator A. And now, simply by dimensional analysis, if you're at the critical point and you're looking at the thermal expectation value of some operator OA, then by dimensional analysis, this has to be some universal coefficient times some energy scale, which is set by temperature here, is the only energy scale you have, raised to the scaling dimension of the operator. Okay, so plugging this back in here, you obtain essentially a sum of terms, and you organize the expansion in increasing scaling dimensions, or increasingly irrelevant operator. So if you consider the leading operators in the expansion, you have the identity operator, which just gives you the zero temperature correlation function. The first leading operator is the relevant scalar here. So the scaling dimension depends on this correlation length exponent. And the next leading operator usually is the stress sensor, which has dimension 3, which is protected against the quantum fluctuations, okay, because it's a conserved quantity. So now the question is, can we predict, can we say anything about this finite temperature connectivity from supersymmetry? So unfortunately, this leading term, we can't say anything about it, really. It's probably non-zero. But apart from the power, which we know reasonably well, we can't really say much about this coefficient. However, turns out that we can say something about the next leading term. Okay, so this coefficient here is related to a three-point function of two currents and one stress tensor. And what is interesting, actually, is that this correlation function is highly constrained by a combination of conformal invariants, Edwardian entities for the conserved U1 symmetry, and supersymmetry. Okay, so it turns out that the one knows what is the functional form of the three-point function of the supercurrent superfield. And from that, we can extract essentially the tensorial form of this JGT correlation function. And from this, we can actually prove rigorously that this coefficient must be zero. Okay, so, and this is should be true for all critical points with emergent n equal 2 supersymmetry in 3 spacetime dimensions. Okay, so we don't have the full form of this connectivity at finite temperature, but we can show exactly that at least this term here is not present in the expansion. So hopefully that should help constrain numerical studies, for instance, of the critical point if you try to fit the optical connectivity to some particular functional form. Okay, so this is the end of, yes?
Is it possible that B5 is related to some coefficient in the expansion
for theta at the moment? Well, B5, so this will be related to a JJ phi squared correlation function.
So it's actually related to the TT phi squared, sorry.
Yeah, this will be related to TT phi squared, yes.
So it could be similar. Like eta omega divided by sigma omega.
Yeah, so there will, so there will definitely be a universal ratio between, I would think, between these B phi squared and the corresponding B phi squared for the expansion of the connectivity. That's right. I mean, the whole function, I mean, if you take these two terms together, of course, the ratio will not be, that order by order, that's right, yes. That's correct, yes.
Actually, now, is it in the bosonic model, is BT known? Is it enormously small? I mean, initially, you could understand, sort of sufficiently close to supersymmetric case in some sense that BT is a bit smaller than it might.
I think it's minus 0.6. Or, I don't know if you remember that. Is that possible?
From the numerics?
From the numerics, yes, the Monte Carlo.
That was a very rough estimate. We were just completely dominated by the DeFi spectrum.
Mm.
I wouldn't trust anything on CT in that numerics.
Okay. That's right, because that's already the second term in the temperature depends. Yeah. So, okay, so I'm basically done. So that's the summary, and thank you for your attention.
I was confused what you said about numerically checking this answer for the coronary entanglement entropy. So are you imagining simulating the thing that realizes on the surface of the TI?
Yeah, that's the problem, right? So how would you do this? So one question is whether this really depends on time reversal symmetry. Okay, so as you said, imagine you consider a model where, imagine you consider a two-dimensional lattice model with two direct fermions. And now I add some Wilson mass term. I gap out one of the direct fermions by some T-breaking mass term. That's right. So now you have another relevant parameter to tune. But numerically, you could tune these two parameters. And then if you can perform the calculation there, then I think then this result should apply. Yeah. So strictly speaking, if you want it to be a bona fide quantum critical point with only one relevant direction, then you have to be on the surface. But ultimately, you don't necessarily have to do that. Yeah.
What is the idea for how to measure this dynamical viscosity?
Yeah, I don't know. No ideas. Any ideas are welcome. I mean, in a sense, it's a... I don't know.
Well, it's very easy. If you know, in an ordinary electron system, it controls the damping of plasma modes, for example. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, as was mentioned earlier, you know, other extrinsic effects control the damping of these collective modes. But in an ideal, for the intrinsic plasma lifetime would be controlled by the high frequency scope.
Very good. Thank you. That's better than I could have thought.
Also, I remember my confusion. I think your slides are fine.
Okay.
There's a factor 4 over pi that's floating around that.
I see. And that's close to 1 in a sense. So, good.
So, can you look at what it was like on entanglement entropy?
Yes.
So, the claim is asymptotic form for real theta holds for theta close to pi.
Yes.
So, meaning that when the surface is smooth, when the boundary is smooth, the logarithmic term is just not there.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah, that's right. And then there's some expansion, and then you can. From this also, I think you can get a bound on the exact coefficient A of theta, also, but the
exact
an exact bound, but not an exact form for the entire theta defense. Yeah.
So this second relation between lambda and CT, that's not proven.
Proven, yes, by these. So this was a conjecture here, and these folks proved it. Yeah.
Questions? Okay, thanks Joseph again.